Okay, hi everybody. This is Joanne, and welcome to Read Science once again. And today we are speaking with TV producer and incidentally an author of an adorable book, Lucy Cook. She is known online as the Amphibian Adventure and also Slothville. So my understanding is that her fascination with sort of the ugly animal has taken her around the world. As a TV producer, and she also has come across sloths and has done more than anybody else in the whole world, I think, to draw attention to these super adorable animals through her independent videos that have gone viral, and also through her work with every imaginable place you can watch nature shows on TV, which include PBS and Discovery and Animal Planet and National Geographic, and you're a National Geographic explorer too. So welcome, Lucy. I'm not going to read your entire bio because I think we will get around to all of that. We're really glad to have you here.
Yeah, no, I'm thrilled to be here. So thanks very much for asking me. It's a delight. It's a delight to experiment with new technology. It's so exciting.
This is great because it's automatically filmed. I don't have to edit. It's just there, right?
It just... All the bloopers. Everything we say gets recorded. That's a worry.
That's right.
But anyway,
yeah. It'll be all right.
Sometime we'll record the preliminary before the on-air bit for the outtakes reel, I think.
Yeah,
where everybody's adjusting the camera and their sound and everything and trying to get their little name to show up at the bottom. So it's all working out. It's going really well. So, wow, I don't even know where to begin. So, of course, we're Read Science. Jeff and I are big advocates for not just science literacy, but literacy in general, and think you should pick up a book about science or nature every once in a while. And that's how you qualify for being here today. Not just, you know, we love great people in general, but because you've written this really adorable book.
Hey, you've got it! I'm so glad. That's great.
I've got it.
Yeah.
I tell you, my kids have read through it, and they have so much fun. So this book comes from your explorations of Costa Rica.
Yeah.
And so why don't you tell us a little more about it? And I'll sort of flip through some pictures while you're talking.
Well, you know, I'm a zoologist by trade and a filmmaker. I've been a filmmaker for years, and I was taking a sort of a sabbatical to travel around South America for 6 months, investigating the amphibian extinction crisis and writing a blog called The Amphibian Avenger. And at the very end of my trip, I stopped at this sloth sanctuary in Costa Rica that I had a hunch would be a really terrific story. I've got a massive soft spot for sloths. They've got a fantastic, peculiar biology. And as an evolutionary biologist, I'm obsessed with freaky quirks of evolution, and sloths are definitely one of those. So I was really excited to go and visit the sanctuary, and because I thought it would be a good story, perhaps for a documentary. And when I got there, it was even better than I could possibly have imagined. It was home to 150 sloths. Judy Arroyo, the woman who runs it, is an amazing woman who knows an incredible amount about sloths. I don't think anybody knows as much as her in the whole wide world. She's the original sloth whisperer, and a great character. And there's just some really wonderful, fun people there who work there, Claire and Becky. And I just thought, it was a really terrific story. And I made a tiny 90-second video, and the sloths were just outrageously charming. You know, they're super charismatic, really and funny and compelling. And I was like, I cannot believe that these animals aren't superstars like pandas. I mean, they're amazing, you know. So I made a little video, and I posted it online, and it went insanely viral. It got picked up by literally every newspaper across the world. I mean, it was a mad, mad week. And celebrities...
Was this the bucketful video?
No, the bucket one was the most recent one I did. I've now done a whole string of sloth virals. I'm like, somebody even called me the Spielberg of sloth movies. I wear that badge with a lot of pride, I can tell you. I was really like, it's almost the best thing that there's ever been said about me, actually. But the first one I made was called Meet the Sloths, and I posted that, oh, I don't know, Joanna was pretty early on to it as well.
Yeah.
That was probably about 3 years ago now I posted that video.
That sounds about right.
Yeah,
because
almost
a
exactly.
friend introduced
it was
me.
May, exactly. Yeah, May 2010.
Yeah.
And because it went just nuts, I mean, just was like everywhere. And so Simon and Schuster got in touch with me, and this really terrific woman there got in touch and said, "Hey, you know, we've read your blog, and you know, we love your photos of the sloths, and we think, you know, we'd love to write for you to write a book about sloths, you know." And I never really thought about writing before, but obviously I just said yes, because, you know, you're not going to say no to that, you know. And and I also thought it would be a great, you know, publicity tool for the sanctuary, and, you know, could be used as a fundraiser for them. And so it seemed like it was a really good idea to do it. So I did that. And then around about the same time, Animal Planet also got in touch, and then they commissioned me to make a full-length documentary about the sanctuary as well. So I ended up doing both things at the same time. I kept going back and forth to film, and then I was also taking photos for the book. So the book and the film are really kind of companion pieces, basically.
Okay. The book and the Animal Planet?
Exactly, yeah, the Animal Planet. In the States, the documentary was called Two Cute Baby Sloths.
Two Cute Baby Sloths.
Which, you know, I have to say, I'm not wildly keen on that title.
You know what, though? I had four teenage girls here yesterday, and we were talking about it. And they were like, too cute. And it was like they just automatically said it.
Yeah.
Without knowing about, you know what I mean, actually remembering the name. Oh,
yeah.
Baby sloths are too cute.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, as they're flipping through your book and everything. So what you've done in this book, though, what I like, and it's what you did in the TV show, was you highlight the characters, because each of these sloths would have a different personality.
Mm.
And, yeah. and so you write little texts that, you know, that sort of describe how, you know, and sort of the anatomy, the appearance of sloths, and as well as their behaviors,
yeah,
and as well as their personality quirks, and the things they do day to day to keep these sloths healthy and rehabilitate them.
Mm.
So, but you do it, you know, it's not dry at all. It's really adorable.
Well, I think the big thing for me about communicating science and also communicating what I'm really passionate about is conservation. And I think, you know, there's a lot of kind of ennui out there. People are a bit beaten to the ground by a conservation message, and it's quite difficult to try and preach to the unconverted, to try and bring in a new audience. I'm all about trying to bring a new audience in and get new people who wouldn't normally watch natural history or be interested in conservation interested. You know, and I think the thing that I can do, which is, you know, which is what I enjoy doing, is to try and bring some humor to it. So I always think of like humor as like the sugar coating that covers the bitter pill. So you still get the message in there, but you cover it with something that's really entertaining. So it doesn't feel like it's a labor. I want people to sort of enjoy these things and to sort of learn as a sort of byproduct of being entertained, basically, is really my mission with almost everything that I do. So, you know, with the book and the film, very much, I did exactly what you said. It's just like I kind of blur the lines of reality and fiction, basically. So, you know, I do imagine that the sloths have different personalities, but I'll also tell you about their biology at the same time. So it's a kind of a mixture of the two, yeah.
So, yeah, because I'm even looking here, I'll read this little segment. This should not violate any copyright here. The burgeoning brood brought. Pardon me?
I'm giving you permission.
So Lucy, Lucy is free to give you permission to do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to read the whole book. So,
yeah.
The burgeoning brood brought together two families of sloth. They are defined by how many digits they have, but you don't have to count their fingers to tell them apart. On Buttercup's sides, the Bradypus, or three-fingered sloth, is the Muppet with the medieval haircut and Mona Lisa smile. You know, so that kind of language is, I think, really, really effective. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just dry biology description. So then you describe the two-toed sloths as a cross between a Wookiee and a pig. So we've got all sorts of cultural references.
Yeah,
that help bring this to life.
Since you mentioned toes, I would like to tap into the evolutionary biologist with a couple of quick questions that I had while I was watching your introductory talk for the Sloth Appreciation Society.
Oh, yeah.
At least the first half of it before your videographer's arm got tired.
Yeah.
And this is actually sneaking in a little bit of science, but I thought it would be very interesting to hear the short answers. That you said that there are two big divisions in the sloth: two-toed, three-toed, and then as a bit of a phrase you said, and this is a good example of convergent evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I know what you're saying, but I'd like to see how. What was that? It's like, how did they converge on this, and one with two and one with three, and why aren't they related? And then how do you as a scientist know that there were convergent evolution rather than branching?
Well, the convergent evolution isn't to do with their fingers, it's to do with their lifestyle. So basically, you may well have heard of, or you may well know, I mean, it's a sort of, this is one of the reasons why I love sloths so much, is because they've got this fantastically rich evolutionary history. They were once like a fantastically diverse group, and there were gazillions of species of sloths, and they evolved in isolation in South America when South America was still an island. And actually, the majority of sloths were ground-dwelling. In actual fact, there was one that was the size of an elephant and weighed about, I can't remember how, Megarithium it was called. It was a massive, great big, the giant ground sloth. So the way that the two-fingered and the three-fingered sloths are actually convergent is that they're both living in the trees. So that's okay. The convergent part of their evolution, in that they've both evolved from ground-dwelling sloths,
mm-hmm.
but now they live in the trees, basically.
They both adopted this way of making a living.
Exactly.
Okay.
Because, and you know, the reason, I mean, you get, you know, the ground-based sloths all got wiped out by good old mankind when mm-hmm. he came across the land bridge and from North America. When South America crashed into North America and man came down the land bridge through Panama before the days of the canal, right. And wandered into South America, went, look at the size of that roast dinner.
Yeah.
There's Megarithium, you know, wandering around, and then, you know, all the ground-based sloths all got wiped out, basically.
Right.
For a long time, people thought it was the Ice Age, but it looks like it was probably hunting that was the final nail in their coffin.
Is this one of the few examples we know of humans being the selective pressure?
Oh, unfortunately not, no. I think there's an awful lot more.
A lot of those?
Yeah.
Okay, where their groups have evolved because of these.
I think they put I don't think the sloths went up into the trees after the humans went down. I think they'd already gone up into the trees.
They'd already survived
exactly, because they weren't so easy to see, basically.
Right. Right. And then the other one is, we go by this fascinating fact when you're pointing out the big-bellied sloth, that their body weight can be at times as much as 2/3 stomach contents.
Yeah.
And that has to do with metabolism and alkaloids and poisons in the leaves and things. Mm. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I this is the thing that I love the most. This is one. I mean, I'm very flattered, Jeff, that you watched my talk. I'm very chuffed. You obviously do very thorough in your research, so thank you very much for doing that. But
my pleasure.
It's one of the things that I think so amazing about sloths is the key to their slothfulness is their diet, you know. And what one might imagine is that their diet is low in nutrition, and that's the reason why they're slow. And that is partly true. But actually, the real reason why they're slow is because they need to process their food extremely slowly, because it's chock full of toxins. And if they, and their digestion, it takes them one whole month to digest a single leaf. Which is incredible. But if they had a quick metabolism and they processed it all quickly, then they'd literally, their livers wouldn't cope and they'd poison themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that they've managed to sort of, you know, because the thing is that you know, leaves don't want to be eaten by the sloth, just like, or anything, you know, just like, you know, wildebeest don't want to be eaten by lions. So it's their protection. But the sloth has evolved to cope with that. But in order to cope with that and to eat the leaves, he's had to slow right down. And so his whole physiology is basically based around being a kind of a couch potato that just is going to digest pretty slowly. He's basically a hanging stomach, you know.
Yeah. And you mentioned that they have, I think you mentioned that they have multiple stomachs, but they're not ruminant animals like cows, are they?
No, they're not. Because they don't regurgitate. I don't know whether it's because being upside down, it could be awkward with regurgitating. Cows do the regurgitating thing, but they're not obviously related to cows. So, you know, the four-chambered stomach, of course, is another example of convergent evolution.
Mm-hmm.
presumably, mm-hmm. because, I mean, cows and sloths are going to be pretty
distant,
far apart, you know, so...
Yeah,
I mean, you know, I think that's why I, you know, that's why I love them is because they've got like, I mean, there's so much fascinating biology in there that opens up so many kind of fantastic kind of questions about evolution and about physiology. And, you know, my whole thing about, you know, is that people for a long time think being sloths are slow and therefore they're lazy and stupid. And my whole thing, as you know, Jeff, because you've watched the talk, is that being fast is overrated, you know, mm-hmm. and that... I, you know, a lot of people sort of, you know, would rather the sloth was called something different and are embarrassed about it being slow. I'm like, go for being slow. Being slow is great. You know, being yeah. slow and sleeping a lot, that's a fantastic strategy. It's just, it's different to being fast and being a cheater or whatever, but it's just as good and maybe even a bit more successful because there's a lot more sloths around than there are cheaters, if you think about
well,
it.
Yeah, so. There's a good lesson for how science works, too, because people... some people might think that we scientists, spend most of our time, if we want to know about, if you want to know about how the brain works, you go and look at lots of people's brains. They don't always realize that you learn a lot by looking at the unusual, the extreme, or the pathological cases. And you can learn a lot about all sorts of digestive things and biological things by looking at the very unusual case. The sloth is what I'm hearing you're saying.
Mm-mm. Yeah, totally. Yeah, absolutely.
Because you look at it to see and say, well, this is odd and unusual. It's like, why is that? And that sheds light on the non-unusual parts just as well, but sometimes in a very clear way.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. It just might not seem as glamorous on the surface, but they have an awful lot to teach us, the sloths.
Well, and they look cute in buckets.
Yeah, and they look very cute in buckets as well, yeah.
So this actually brings up an interesting point that I do want you to expand on, is that you studied under Richard Dawkins. You're a biologist who became a TV producer, a filmmaker and a TV producer. Mm. So you're not just the TV producer who has an interest in biology. I mean, you've done the work.
Mm. Yeah. No, I was very, very, very lucky indeed. I read The Selfish Gene when I was a teenager and was just... you know, blown away by him. I mean, I think he's one of the greatest science writers there is. He's a fantastic, I'm talking about communication, you know, I mean, there's two books that were a massive influence on my career, you know, if we're talking about books and science. And David Attenborough's Life on Earth, when I was 8 years old, it was the book, you know, and it had the tree frog on the front. I don't know whether you had it in the States. It had the red-eyed tree frog.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm obsessed with amphibians after that and evolution, you know, I mean, it completely... changed my life and put me in a direction and it was all about animals for me from that point on. And then when I was a teenager, reading Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene, which obviously took you that step further, you know, because he took, you know, Darwinism and he very cleverly reduced it to the gene and, you know, it was such a sort of, you know, it was just a sort of, you know, amazing book and beautifully written argument. And I discovered that he was a tutor at Oxford University and that he taught four people a year were lucky you could apply to New College and you could be taught by this man. And I was like, wow, well, that would be cool, wouldn't it? You know, so I applied and I was very nervous when I went to go and have my interview with him. And he's a very extraordinary, he's brilliant, you know, I mean, he's a terrifyingly clever man. I mean, writing my first essay for him was absolutely terrifying, just like, you know, but he's a brilliant teacher, and I was very lucky I got in, and I had 3 years where I had one-to-one tutorials with him. I was, you know, he taught me evolution and animal behavior, so, you know, I mean, I'm blessed. I mean, I literally can't, and then since then, obviously, he's now become this massive public figure, and, you know, so, I mean, I was incredibly lucky, basically, you know, and, you know, very grateful.
That's amazing. Well, and it shows through the TV shows you make, that you create, because first of all, The Sloths, which really is a story, but then you followed up with your unloved creatures, and the name's escaping me. But
Freaks and Creeps, that was the one for National Geographic, yeah.
Yes, Freaks and Creeps, and you just went traveling everywhere looking for the oddest, most unusual creatures you could find.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And what I wanted to do was, well, I wanted to shine a light on all the animals that don't hit the headlines, you know. So we went to Borneo and I ignored the orangutans. Like, no, the orangutans have got enough fame. What other animals are there there? And we did, you know, proboscis monkeys, which are the, you know, hilarious looking. They've got perpetual wind, gas the whole time. They sit around. It's like the bean scene from Blazing Saddles around the monkey, like the whole time. And they've got these long, wibbly, rather, you know, rude noses. And, you know, and they've also got a four-chambered stomach that takes a long time to digest their food. There's a theme emerging here, actually. As well, and all these other, because I want people to appreciate the diversity. I want people to, I worry about the emotional bias of conservation and focusing a lot of money on certain species and certain target areas, right, getting a lot of focus, right, and really sort of spreading that love out. And I just think they unlock these quirky, fantastic evolutionary stories, you know. I mean, I just, it's just, for me, it's the most brilliant thing, you know. So,
I'm sorry. We're sort of near a question that I wrote down when you were talking earlier. You mentioned the idea of conservation ennui. Think about that for a minute while I do my preamble, because Joanne and I are always frequently talk together about how to integrate science as a cultural activity rather than sort of extra credit when it comes to life for ordinary people. And that may be very much, it's like we understand that some people can be very passionate about this animal, that animal, saving this part of the rainforest, saving these sand dunes. All of these are very worthwhile things, but an individual, and then to try to get a group to do something effective, can only do so much. And so the question is, how can you integrate this into, you know, a normal lifestyle, this sensitivity, this awareness, an outlook to conservation, and avoid the ennui so that things can be treated with more respect in nature without wearing everyone out and without trying to get everyone to devote their life to a cause?
Well, I mean, it's a big old question, that. But what I think is, I think people should feel good about doing their best. And I think whatever you can do, mm-hmm, whatever you are doing, that's, you should feel good about that. You know, I think it's important for people to feel proud of what they do and not feel bad about what they're not doing, for number one, I think, you know.
And like making films about endangered but unbeautiful, unpopular animals is certainly a contribution to that. And all of it sort of moves us slowly into an awakening awareness or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think getting, from my point of view, getting as many stories out there. I just want to sort of excite people about caring about, mm-hmm, the natural world. That's what I want to do. I want people to love it like I love it. And then if they love it like I love it, then they'll want to do what they can within their capabilities to try and to hold on to it a bit longer. Whether that's switching from using, you know, bleach to an eco-friendly toilet cleaner, or it's, you know, it's going and volunteering, or it's donating money, or it's whatever it is, you know, I hope it inspires, basically. That's all I can really do, basically.
Raising the awareness of remarkable diversity. Aren't people surprised that there are so many different kinds of animals? Don't we tend to think of, you know, a lot of people think of animals like, well, there are lions and tigers and maybe elephants, and it's like two or three more. And, you know, do they know how many species of butterfly there is, or how many species of bacteria live in their body? There's an amazing amount, and, you know, what a lesson for evolutionary biology to teach us. But
yeah, I mean, I think it's really difficult. I'm obsessed with biodiversity, and I'm obsessed with trying to sort of, you know, because it's the interconnectedness. I tell you what I always say is, I always say nature's like a game of Jenga, you know, the building block game. And if you pull, you don't know which block you'll pull out will make the whole stack collapse. Mm-hmm. And so that's how food chains are. You know, everything is so intrinsically linked with each other that you don't know whether, you know, by pulling out the frogs or by losing a cricket over there or by losing, you know, some microbial bacteria that goes extinct or whatever is going to be the thing that actually makes the whole system mm-hmm. collapse. So, you know, that interconnectedness is a very important message to get across, because it makes, I want people to care about not just the charismatic, fluffy animals at the top, mm-hmm. which are very easy to be impressed by and fall in love with, but also to care about saving the woodlouse, you know, and all the other bits. So, because it's all part of a big system that mm-hmm. works as a whole.
Yeah, very good, yeah.
And it's difficult to, you know, the language doesn't really help with all that thing. I'm always sort of cursing the word biodiversity, because I'm always trying to look for another word for biodiversity, because I think those sort of rather sciencey words are a turnoff to general public. I think, you know, the people that I really want to kind of draw in, I think it's you know, one wants to try and think of words. And I really struggle with what I say instead of biodiversity, because obviously you want to have shorthand as well. So, but it is incredibly important to me to try and get that message mm-hmm. across.
So that you brought up exactly what I was thinking, because as I'm listening to you, you're throwing in cultural references. You're like, oh, this is like a scene from Blazing Saddles. Nature is like mm-hmm. a game of Jenga. You're mm-hmm. really trying to bring in these cultural references. And then I was going to then follow it up with, you know, about the language, about the scientific language, which when you study science, you become very comfortable with it, and mm-hmm. sometimes you forget mm-hmm. that other people are not comfortable with it, you know, because I had to stop myself from saying morphology, you know, when we were talking about the shape and the function of science.
Don't use the M word.
Yes. So, you know, and I've heard all sorts of things. I've talked to various TV producers or scientists who've been approached to do TV things, and, you know, and even saying the word like divide, you know, just will, you know, cause a problem with the TV producer. Like, you can't say that. You know, so there are a lot of words that maybe you can't say, because you'll turn off viewers. You'll turn off the very people you're trying to attract.
I mean, it's tricky, because, you know, if you dumb things down too much, then you lose mm-hmm. you know, you lose a devoted audience. So to a certain extent, you have to cut your cloth for, you know, the way that I communicate is different according to which outlet it is. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? So, you know, the Meet the Sloths and the book, they're really for, you know, the widest audience possible, you know, so they're and for kids as well. So I've chucked in loads of cultural references and cushioning to make it an easy pill to swallow. But, you know, if you're doing something for, say, you know, BBC Two in England, then the audience won't actually really like it if you dumb it down too much. You know, you need to sort of, so to a certain extent you need to, but yeah, I mean, I think it is very difficult for scientists, because it's almost like learning a new language, you know, because, mm-hmm. you know, you are, and I think as a scientist as well, you know, there's a real sort of need to speak proper, you know, that's how, and you're constantly, as a scientist, you're worrying about what your peers are going to think about what you're saying, you know, and actually, you know, and so, and if you didn't use morphology and you said, you know, body shape or something instead, then you're worrying your peers will go, why didn't they say morphology? You know, like, what's wrong with them? Didn't they know the word, you know?
Right.
So I think it's like, it's a whole, you know, which is why, you know, somebody, you know, like I mean, I studied zoology, so I studied for 3 years, but then I went off and I was a filmmaker for 20, you know, so I'm kind of like, I'm more entertainment than I am science, really, which is, I think, why I'm in a good position for kind of popularizing science, because I've been corrupted by entertainment and comedy, basically.
Well, I'm all for appropriate vocabulary to reach the audience. I don't much care for the phrase dumbed down. It sounds patronizing to me, but we know what we're talking about. And I think that's great, and I love journalists and science writers and even scientists who can find the language for the audience. And what really ticks me off is people who try to find an appropriate language but are sloppy and inaccurate with metaphors and explanations and vocabulary that they end up choosing, so that they leave misleading impressions. You're in a much better position to avoid that, having been the zoologist becoming the filmmaker, and that is like really high on my list of really important things, because I feel so strongly about, when we're talking to the public, they're trusting us as an outlet, we have to be very careful not to tell them something inaccurate or misleading, I think.
I'm with you 100%, Jeff. It's funny because I'm just doing a new series, which I'm really excited about, for BBC One in the UK, which I'm presenting, a series called Talk to the Animals, and I'm going to meet experts in animal communication. I'm going to fly around the world and meet and find out how we're learning to communicate with animals, right? Mm-hmm. So not with sort of, but with the actual science, not sort of whisperers. Mm-hmm. It's right. More kind of a proper sort of with proper science. And the company that are making it, it's very exciting because they're not a company that's made natural history documentary before. And so they're new to it. But I think that's exciting because they bring, they've got very interesting ideas about storytelling and like I said, bringing it wide audience to it. But it was very important to me, and they totally agreed 100%, that we had a top scientific advisor on the case to go through the scripts to make sure that, because mm-hmm. you know, it's been a while since I was at university. I can't rely on myself. Do you know what I mean? I need to I need to double check that I'm getting things right with professionals. So we have
an
advisor on that. So I think it's really important. I think it's a good combination that. Getting some, getting mm-hmm. Really good, strong scientific, advice, and then sort of kind of modern, non-scientific people making science programs. It could be really good.
It's exceedingly valuable. Yeah.
So that's interesting. So this would include the, the sign language for the gorillas, like Coco, and beyond, right?
No, we're not. What we're not going to do is we're not going to do a lot of that. This is all about humans learning to speak animal rather than teaching animals to speak human.
That's what I was wondering, you're going to their level. You're going to communicate with them on their level instead of saying, we can train them to speak like us. Okay.
Sure. So there's quite a lot of, it's quite a kind of buzzy new area in animal behavior as far as I can tell. And there's some fantastic research in terms of decoding everything from chickadees, and prairie dogs are incredible. They've done loads of work with prairie dogs. They're hilarious. They've got a different word for different predators, they worked out that if you walk through a prairie dog area, then they'll go and they'll shout out, they'll go human fat, tall, pink t-shirt, and then if you walk through it again and you change your t-shirt and you're wearing green, they go human tall, green t-shirts, they don't say t-shirt obviously, but they recognize colors, they say And this is a huge amount of work that's been done on that, and I know it's going to be hilarious. It's going to be a brilliant series. Actually, I have
this
to say.
Reminds me of the Far Side comic, Gary Larson. Yeah. If you've ever read that, and he had the dog translator, and that they found out what dogs really just say is "Hey, hey, 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 hey,
yeah. hey." Yeah, I know. Yeah, I love Gary Larson. I worship at his feet. So there'll be a lot of kind of Gary Larson-esque jokes from me about what. But what for me is so exciting about this, of the idea of us learning about bear communication, is it's a window inside their heads. Do you know what I mean? It's a way to get inside an animal's head and understand, rather than looking at their world through the prism of our existence, but to try and understand, their sensory and, mental world, So, it's going to be very exciting.
Are there going to be any animals inside of giant NMR machines, magnetic resonance machines doing
fMRI?
No, I don't think we are. I'm going to Panama to make a robotic frog, though, which I'm very excited about.
You do like your frogs.
And now we can come back to frogs, since we promised that we would talk about sloths and frogs today. Frogs.
I think that Lucy's frozen.
Oh, she is, but she is, maybe that's her bandwidth, and maybe if we keep talking, she'll come back.
She'll show up. So actually, this I'm going to sort of embarrass myself, but because of my love of sloths, I've accumulated a few stuffed animals here. This one is joining me. I have I think another one in another room there, but
Does this one have three toes or two toes?
This is the three-toed.
Okay.
With the banding at the eye, but the they actually did put three toes. Look at that.
Three toes in.
We'll see if Lucy joins us joins us again here soon. Yeah, so she's apparently also going to be doing, oh my goodness, I'm looking at her bio here, like an 8-part series about sloths. So let's see. So her show, her primetime series for BBC One is what she's been talking about, called Talk to the Animals, in which she travels the globe to learn how to communicate with elephants, whales, and chimps. She is, of course, already fluent in sloth. and then, I'm trying to see where it says here that it was another whole 8-episode series about sloths. And, you know, so she focused her first one in Costa Rica, but there are many, many places that sloths live, so she's able to travel more widely across South America, I believe, for this next series. So,
when this video is done, I'll be posting the link that we have to some of her online videos. And when we were talking before the program about all the mini programs she's produced there, they've been produced and shown in so many different venues that it's hard to collect up an entire listing of those. But fortunately, we have search engines to look for Lucy Cook's name as a producer and presenter and biologist on various, various projects.
So I've got here, she's won many awards, including a big award for a documentary, her documentary work for the general public. So, we are talking, this is, I think, really big. I'm trying to find it. It's like the Wild Screen Film Festival that's held every year. So she's got, what I'm trying to do right now is actually send her a link to come back if her computer's behaving. I think she'd probably figure that out too. But I want to make sure that we can get her.
It's exciting being a pioneer of technology.
That's right. Well, and everybody's computer is different. And of course, now that I teach online, I get to learn the foibles of the computer system. Mm-hmm. And so I run across that quite a bit. I've learned to troubleshoot. But she's sort of radio silence here, so I don't know if she's trying to work on that and all of that. So let's see. Well, why don't we take this few minutes here and then talk about what's coming up next week. For sure, the one thing for sure is Buzz Aldrin on Wednesday. So
on Wednesday I'll go and look. I'll get the time. At 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Eastern time.
Eastern time, so noon my time, and then that will be 10 a.m. his time, I believe. He'll be on the Pacific Coast. Yes. And what's great about this, what I'm really looking forward to is, first of all, he's written many books, but his latest book is called Mission to Mars, and he lays out a plan on, you know, how do we get to Mars? You know, what is this going to look like collaboration-wise between countries and agencies, the public sector and private businesses, and what I really like about it is how he sort of tells the story to bring people who maybe not been keeping up with the space bar, and brings people up to date, young people up to date. Yay, Lucy's back. and then it's also a good way for people to catch up on what's happening in the modern world. Yay, Lucy!
Sorry,
there.
I'm so sorry. I knew the technology would be too much for me in the end. My power ran out.
I figured it would be power.
Power. Yeah. That's funny. That's okay, because we were just talking about some of your
embarrassing
upcoming. We were embarrassing you. No.
what were you saying while I was in blackout?
we were talking about. That you have an 8-part series coming up about sloths, like a follow-up, right?
Yeah. The 1 hour that I made did very, very well for Discovery, and so they've commissioned eight half hours about the sanctuary, which will be coming out on Animal Planet. Probably autumn, Christmas time. So that's good. And then I've also got, the other exciting thing is that I'm, that's a kind of different way of communicating that I'm very excited about, is I have an app. I've collaborated with this fantastic organization called Jumping Pages, who are like award-winning app producers. And they got in touch with me, well, with my literary agent, actually, and they wanted to do something around the book. And so what I really wanted to do is, because I know that everybody always wants, a lot of people want a pet sloth, and I totally obviously don't approve of...
Oh, yes, while you were gone, by the way, I embarrassed myself by showing
You are allowed to have that, that's because I know how much you love them. So you'll love this. So I thought it would be a really good idea if people could have a pet sloth, but on their phone, so they could have, they could adopt their own sort of, sloth, and they could care for it, and they could feed it, hibiscus flowers, and, choose what it dreams about, and, like a Tamagotchi.
Help it down to the bottom of the tree.
Yeah, take it to go poo, exactly, yeah. And this fantastic app collaborators, app company thought that was a terrific idea and were really into it. And we're doing it. They're just coming to the end of, the development phase, and it's going to be out in sort of July. I think it's June now, isn't it? July or was no September, September. It's going to be out in September. So, and what I think is that is, it's what I'm saying. I think it's a way of getting a message across without being preachy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I think people can learn about sloth biology. They can learn, about their conservation, and that they're best off in the wild, and but it's a fun way of finding all these things out rather than it being a kind of preachy message, you mustn't do this and you mustn't do that, and
it's so fantastic. I love the concept. I know kids already I can think of who would love it, and you could even branch out. Once you're past the sloths, you could do other animals that
it's true, absolutely.
Frogs, we just they need more attention, I think.
They do.
The frogs are a hard sell. They are harder for me to get. But I have just made a little short film about our trip. I went to Colombia to look for the world's most toxic animal, which is this incredible, really poisonous banana yellow frog, Phyllobatus terribilis. I actually horrifically nearly... I mean, I came that close to killing myself. It was awful. I basically went in the jungles of Colombia. This thing is so outrageously poisonous that you have to wear gloves when you pick it up, and if a microgram of its poison got into your bloodstream, you'd be dead in 3 minutes flat, and there is no antidote. One frog sweats out enough poison to kill two bull elephants in 3 minutes flat, and it's the most potent neurotoxin known. So I'm in the jungle, I'm with these conservationists, and we find the frog, and because I love frogs so much, I I'm holding it with my gloves on, and I'm shaking like a leaf, and it's like holding a loaded gun, and I'm like there, and I'm holding this thing, and I'm like, and then I'm just overwhelmed by how beautiful it is, and I burst into tears, and I go, because I'm overwhelmed, I forget what I'm doing, and I go to wipe the tears away from my eye. I got that close. And everybody's
That would put an end to all the good work you're doing.
It would be a really awkward way to go, wouldn't it, basically?
But it would be, she was doing what she loves.
Cameras running.
It's in the video that I've made, actually. Yeah, it's in the video. It's the latest video that I've published on my Vimeo page. It's The Search for the Golden Poison Frog. So if you watch that, you'll see me come within a whisker of killing myself, basically. And then get very embarrassed by it.
while we have you before your next battery runs down, I'm glad you came back, because I was desperate to ask you to retell the story of meeting Sir David Attenborough.
Oh, really? Okay.
I read about your blog, and I thought, I would hope that I could be much cooler than that, but I doubt it.
This is going to pass into TV legend. This is so awkward now that I'm actually doing his job on BBC One as well. I feel even more awkward. about it. But he's obviously, he's like Jesus to me, and you know, he's my, you know, he's other than my parents, he's had the biggest influence on my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's, you know, he's a massive person for me.
Indeed.
I've worshipped him since I was a small child, and so I've wanted to meet him, obviously, you know, since forever. And I was at an amphibian fundraiser at London Zoo about 3 years ago, and it was the night was being hosted by Sir David Attenborough, and he was, you know, raising money, and there were some scientists there and everything. So there was a talk beforehand, and then afterwards they said, right, you know, they'll all be Sir David. We're all going to have drinks now in the amphibian and reptile house, and everybody's going to get a chance to meet Sir David. I'd been sitting in the audience with my notebook. I'm that much of a geek that's got a frog on it. So don't worry, Joanne. You know, I'm with you in the geek stuff. You're not alone. You know, like I'm there with you. You know, so I'm there with my little froggy notebook, and I'm literally going to meet David Attenborough, and I can't believe it. And I'm so excited. And I get my glass of warm Chardonnay, and I'm wandering around the room, and I think I'm stalking. Oh my God, I'm going to see him. And then I see him, and he's there, and he's like, you know, he's like fresh out of the washing machine or something, because his hair's all white and he looks so perfect and sort of smaller than I thought he'd be, you know. But anyway, I go over and he's got this couple of talking to him. And I just sort of, you know, they're asking for his autograph and everything. I think, oh God, how tacky, I'm going to go and save him, I'll save him. So I elbow these people out of the way, four people. And I go, Sir David, I just want to introduce myself. My name's Lucy Cook, and I just want to say... And I just thought, actually, what do I want to say? I just, like, I've waited 30 years, and I don't know what I want to say. And then, so I went, I just want to say what an incredibly profound effect you've had on my life. And then the worst thing possible happened. I burst into tears, and just not, like, just a little bit of tears, but, like, hysterical, racked sobs. You know, the kind of sobbing that's reserved for being brutally dumped by the love of your life. You know, I mean, it was like, I couldn't get control of myself. And I was like there, holding onto his hand, and he's like trying to get his hand out of my hand. And he's being terribly sweet, going, my dear, it's okay. What do you do now? And I went, I'm a filmmaker. It was just awful. Anyway, I just like, thought to myself, look, pull it together. Because, I mean, I'm a director for a living. I direct very well-known people, and you know, this shouldn't be happening to me. I should just be able to get a grip. It's just, you know, anyway, so then the worst thing happened. Even worse than bursting into tears, I said something just completely stupid. First of all, I said, I don't know why this is happening. I've met loads of famous people, which I would never normally say, because it's just an awful thing to say. But then I said, I've met loads of famous people, everybody from Gandhi to, and then I thought to myself, what am I saying? I'm in free fall here. I've never met Gandhi. He died 20 years before I was born. Like, what the hell? It's just synapses are like fusing. And then somebody, I felt these grips, these fingers on my shoulder, and it was a bodyguard person there said, would you mind if somebody else speaks to Sir David now? And they escorted me away from him. And quite quickly out the building, actually, you know. So, and then I realised, as I stood sobbing in the dark outside the zoo trying to hail a taxi, that the reason why I'd said Gandhi was because his brother directed Gandhi, you know. And so basically, right, my brain was just in free fall, and it was just trying to grab onto anything that was familiar, you know, and just saying, just, it was one of those complete, like, bypass loops, you know, just,
wow. It was horrific. So, this is probably good no one caught this on video, camera phone or something.
Yeah. No, nobody saw it. I mean, you know, it was, you know, yeah. So, you know, I mean, I have met him once since then, because I was with a very brilliant producer about a year ago at a conservation awards ceremony. And he knew that story, and he's very good friends with Sir David. And he said, oh, I'll introduce you. And I went, don't do it. Anyway, he marched me up. He's like, Sir David, this is Lucy Cook, and I ditched you. I just went, I'm just not saying anything. Just like keeping it shut, you know, just because I don't want to risk, you know. I'm sure he would remember me. I'm sure he'd remember me. Yeah.
I was imagining a dramatic recreation that undoubtedly would have John Cleese in it, I think.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, so, but it was just, afterwards I sort of really wondered what had happened, because obviously, you know, I have met lots of famous people, and I have kind of been in those situations, and it was the first time I've ever lost my cool like that in any way, shape, or form. But I think it was just that he has had such a massive influence on my life, and somehow it was almost like I was imagining what my life would have been if he hadn't existed or something. Do you know what I mean? It was something very kind of deep and, you know, it really like stirred me up. You know, it was profound. It was profoundly embarrassing, but it was very profound.
Well, how fortunate for you to actually meet him then, you know, despite the drama.
In a memorable fashion.
So, and I guess he just had some surgery for...
I know. He's just had a pacemaker fitted. I know. Yeah. But I mean, he when he's old, he's 87 or something now, But I mean, he's been so... I saw him speak last year. It was a fantastic thing at the Royal Geographical Society. Him and Michael Palin interviewing each other on stage. I mean, it was like... It was like one of those evenings you never want to end. Do you know what I mean? Because it was so these two brilliant storytellers talking to each other, and he's so alert. I mean, he's got such an amazing clear mind. You know, you kind of feel like he could go on forever, but obviously, you know.
Well, biology gives out.
We all send our thoughts to him, hoping that he's okay with his pacemaker, and kind of, you know, because we love him very much.
Sort of a partial consolation, but at least in his many, 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 many wonderful series, he doesn't age, at least. And keep watching those. And
it does seem he's ageless, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So that's, you know, and I'm just wondering how many Americans are not initiated to David Attenborough. You know, I'm a Nova kind of girl. I like Nova. But people have only been raised on, Discovery or Mythbusters and things like that. They may not know who he is and how great he is. And you know, I already run into people who don't know who Jacques Cousteau is. And I'm like, oh, I love Jacques Cousteau.
Well, they have apparently, in the States, they put a different voice on. The voiceover is not David Attenborough on. David Attenborough is, you know. So,
they do,
you know, he's
actors.
Probably a lot of people in the States will be watching this thinking, who is this person that she's talking about? But, I mean, he is like, he's the god of natural history. I mean, he is in the UK. He is, you know, and you probably will have watched his shows, but you might not know as an American who he is, because his voiceover will have been read by somebody else.
Right, like Alec Baldwin or something. Right?
Maybe it's just important then to get one of the videos in which he's traveling around and appearing, because he's always doing the narrating. That's where I usually see him. Mm. And there's plenty of that in there, easily available. We'll spread the word.
Good.
It's amazing. So I'm just trying to look at your list here. So you won the Panda Award for Best Popular Broadcast Documentary at the Wild Screen Festival. That was in Bristol, wasn't it, last year?
Yeah. That was for the Sloth documentary that I did for Animal Planet. And that, what was really pleasing about that was that I won Popular Documentary. I mean, I made that documentary, and we had like no money. You know, I think we got three finance partners on in the end, and you know, I basically worked for free. I didn't, you know, make any money off it. And you know, independent documentary is not for those with a hankering for an extravagant lifestyle, because it's a passion job. You know, so don't get in it if you like fast cars, because you aren't going to have one. But I don't even have a car. So but what was really pleasing to me was that, you know, we made this show, you know, with on passion. You know, I mean, and we made it with no money, and not no money, but it was a very small budget, because I mean, it's a foreign filming in foreign locations is always, you know, more expensive than filming in your backyard, and we wanted to film over Parrot Passage of Time to show kind of unfolding narratives and all that sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, it was made on a shoestring, and it beat these shows that were like big shows with massive budgets. It was really funny because at the Wild Scream Festival, they had a panel for the finalists. And there was me and then the finalists of the other two in the category. It was one show about an exploding hippo. And then was another show. I can't remember what it was. It was River Monsters. You know, massive, great big show.
Big show.
And they were all like, so one of the questions was like, and how big was your team? And, you know, the exploding hippo show, they said, well, we were about like 50 or 60 people, and River Monsters were like, well, you know, we were quite pared down. We were about like 12 or something like that. And they're like, I was like, well, there was me, there was Phil, who was the cameraman. And then there was, you know, and then there was an editor, and basically that was it. You know, we did everything. You know? So it was one of those great triumphs where, you know, independent filmmaking and passion will out, and you know, makes up for the fact that you're broke.
Right.
You know, it's getting out there basically. You know, and it was nice to feel that you could do something that would compete on a big stage on a small budget, which I think is, you know, is true. I don't think money shouldn't be any disincentive to what your ambitions are, because I think these days you can do an enormous amount of communicating for free.
Yes.
So, you know.
Well, it's true. Here's Jeff and I. We do this, and you know, we get ourselves authors, and you know, they want to come talk to us. They want to get their word out. They're very excited. So, looks like we have 2 minutes left, and I'd just like to ask, what is your advice to someone who wants to break into
anything,
TV production, filmmaking, especially in the nature realm?
Well, I mean, my advice would be get out there and start making stuff, because, you know, these days, you know, you can make an entire film, you know, on your phone. You know, you can even edit it, you know, you can do everything. So I think, you know, and you can also make a film, I believe, about, you don't have to be making films about lions and tigers and in exotic locations. You can make a film about the spider that lives in your bath. Mm. You know, you just start practicing telling stories and start telling stories.
You've just given us a beautiful parable about how content and storytelling can win over production values, and I think that's very inspiring.
Mm.
We're hoping.
We're hoping. Yeah, I hope so. I hope I inspire, because, I mean, you know, we need lots of storytellers. There's a lot of animals out there. You know, there's room for all of us. So, you know, please, everybody, do what I did and go out there and just do your own thing and just, you know, get it happening.
So I'm thinking, Joanne, that we've reached that awkward point where we could continue talking for hours, but we've also gotten to the end of our time and maybe our first list of questions, and it might be time to part for a while.
Yes. Lucy, thank you so much, and for tolerating technology and everything else. And it's been great. It's been great to talk to you and have you share this with everybody, Chris, because I've conversed with you and I follow you on Facebook, and, you know, so I sort of keep up with what you're up to, but it's great for you to come on and share with everybody else.
No,
it's a total
thrill.
Yeah, thanks very much, Lucy. It was all very exciting and new for me, and I'm thrilled. I'll be posting some links, too, that you've given me.
Yes. Yes,
great. Well, listen, thank you both for giving me the opportunity. I've loved talking to you both. And as I say, I'm very fond of Joanne, been supporting me ever since I started out and I had nobody, you know. So very happy to help out anytime. Reading science is very important and I believe in it too. So pleasure to be part of it.
Great.
Thank you
so much, Lucy.
Pleasure.
So you can hang up with the little hang up icon up there, like a handset.
Yep. Bye.
Bye. Okay, so everyone, in the middle of the show, when Lucy disappeared, we did talk about our upcoming show with Buzz Aldrin, and Susie Esterhaus, who's a famous photographer, will also be coming on either next week or the future. I just got an email that could be changing our dates. So, everybody, thank you for tuning in. Mm-hmm. This is great. So I hope you learned something, and we'll keep an eye out for Lucy's work. And you can even pick up her darling little book. Little Book of Sloth. Okay. All right.
Thanks, Joanne. Bye-bye.
Bye, Jeff.